AM Plant on the line. This is the commentary.ca. Vancouver is internationally recognized as one of the best cities in which to live. A new book outlines and discusses what has made the Lower Mainland region what it is today. From the creation of planning boards in the 1940s to saving Strathcona in the late 60s to the agricultural land reserve in the 70s, Expo in the 80s and more, City Making in Paradise, Nine Decisions That Saved Greater Vancouver's Livability, written by Mike Harcourt and Ken Cameron with Sean Rossiter, looks at how we got to where we are today and wonders where we're headed in the future. As an overview of public policy making and planning, it's quite accessible. The people profiled in the events recounted are informative and instructive. I am now joined by one of the book's authors, Mike Harcourt. He was first elected to Vancouver City Council in 1972. From 1980 to 86, he was the mayor of the city of Vancouver. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre and retails for $24.95. I am pleased to welcome to the Planta on the Line program the former premier of the province of British Columbia, Mike Harcourt. Good morning, Mr. Harcourt.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. Why this book and why now?
Well, the book was originally intended to be available for the June 2006 World Urban Forum about the urban legend that there's a new term in Webster's Dictionary called Vancouverism. But it very quickly morphed into a look at why The Economist, the UN, Mercer's International, and others have labeled Vancouver as one of the three, and in some cases the most livable cities in the world, along with Geneva and Zurich. And so we wanted to examine that and to pay tribute to people like Walter Hardwick, who unfortunately passed away before he could get the tribute when he was alive. Walter Hardwick, a renowned urban geographer at UBC and a member of Vancouver City Council, and quite an amazing guy. So we wanted to pay tribute to Walter and others who have helped Vancouver over the last 60 years become one of the most livable cities in the world. So we looked at Ken Cameron and I, with Ken's tremendous experience as a GVRD, Greater Vancouver Region District, head of planning for 25 years, and Sean Rossiter, who had an award-winning column in Vancouver Magazine for 16 years called 12th and Canby, and of course my experience in politics in this region. We wanted to identify the major decisions, and we honed in on nine major decisions that saved Vancouver from having a Gardiner Expressway going through it like Toronto or the Alaska Way in Seattle, and why there's so much green space around it, unlike a lot of other cities to sprawl all out like Phoenix and other places like that. And so we wrote this new version of a book, and it hit all the marks we wanted to, which is it made clear to people that Vancouver, as the most livable city in the world, didn't happen by chance, by coincidence. It was visionary and courageous elected, appointed leaders and citizens who made sure the right decisions took place.
Hey, let's go walk through those nine decisions. The first is the Lower Mainland Regional Planning Board, and that was created after the floods of 1948, correct?
Right, and it came up with the vision that captures the last 60 years, and that's cities in a sea of green, which led to a plan for the whole Lower Mainland, street addresses, five-digit numbers in the Fraser Valley because of the huge area it covers, and a number of other very, very important innovations. They introduced Tom MacDonald, who headed it up, and Jim Wilson, and Tony Carrar, and Bob Williams. There's a bunch of people involved in that, Peter Oberlander. So we pay tribute to those early pioneers who put in place that vision of cities in a sea of green, of farmland, watersheds, significant park and wilderness and wildlife areas. And it had a huge role until it was disbanded by W.E.C. Bennett in the mid-1960s.
And we go into, I guess, because you talk about green space and so on, the agricultural land reserve, how was that significant to this region? I mean, we think of it in provincially and, you know, outside of Vancouver.
I think, Joe, it was significant because British Columbia is 95% mountain, and only about 5% is available for arable farmland, and really high-quality farmland is even less of that 5%. And in the lower mainland, along the Fraser River Delta, you have some of the best, richest farmland in the world, close to a growing population that has grown fourfold since the 1950 period, from about 500 million to about 2.5, if you take the whole region in, million people. So having that farmland available is very important, and it also lets you draw the line where sprawl or the urban edge ends and the green space begins, or vice versa. And there's only three cities that I'm aware of in North America who have been able to successfully accomplish that, Greater Vancouver and the Fraser Valley Regional District being one, Kitchener-Waterloo the second, and Portland. And that then allows you to do the really important decisions around more compact urban development linked by alternatives to the car, so you don't have these Los Angeles-type freeways running out into these low-density suburbs, which creates all kinds of other environmental and human toll costs.
Well, was this idea that we would create a region, think of the region as a whole, is that something that let's say, members of the council in Vancouver or in Port Moody and in Maple Ridge and in White Rock, is that something that they think about when they make decisions that affect themselves?
They do, because of the livable region strategic planning approach that started in the 1970s, and a legendary planner by the name of Harry Lash, who helped develop that approach of engaging citizens to look at the values that are important to people in this region, and to then put that into the plans for individual municipalities that all complement each other with growth quotas and where growth is going to go and how we're going to link the town centers in downtown Vancouver, Burnaby, New Westminster, the North Shore and Lonsdale Quay, Coquitlam, Surrey, Richmond, all those together by rapid transit or a good sea bus, and how you can have complete communities. So those are the four basic values that were put together that municipalities live by that started in the 1970s, the green zone, town centers linked by rapid transit, and centers where you can live, work, play in the same place. And so that formed the basis for the first official livable region plan that Gordon Campbell, when he was mayor, played a very significant role in the 1990s on. And Darlene Mazzeri, who was my Minister of Municipal Affairs, put together the Growth Strategies Act, which encouraged high growth areas like Lower Mainland, British Columbia, the Southeast Vancouver Island, the Okanagan, to work in a cooperative way to put together long-term growth management strategies that link land use and transportation.
Can a livable city be affordable?
Well, a livable city can be affordable or not affordable, but Vancouver is a livable city that is not sustainable. And that's one of the reasons, Joe, that housing prices are driving the middle class out of the city and in some cases the region, and certainly creating a huge problem for the homeless or the working poor, or one paycheck away from being homeless. So housing affordability and availability is one of the reasons that in the last chapter in the book, Ken and Sean and I said, Vancouver, don't get smug. You may be livable, but you're not sustainable. We got high housing prices, homeless issues, drug and crime problems, traffic congestion. We're not dealing with climate change very well. We're energy hogs on a scale unprecedented in the world. We've got big challenges.
In terms of moving out of the town centers and so on, moving out of the central areas of municipalities and so on, out of Vancouver because you can't afford a house. Transportation. See, if you work in Vancouver, the problem is how do you get to work if you live away from work? How do we?
Well, Vancouver is pretty good. I mean, the bus system in Vancouver is extensive because of our grid system of a major street every six blocks, and not only that, because we in 1970 the team council that I was part of changed the zoning in downtown Vancouver, which didn't allow residential housing to be constructed from 1932 to 1975. We changed that and then redeveloped Falls Creek, Yale Town, Coal Harbor, and added many more housing units in the downtown where people work. To the point now where people, the 120,000 or so people that live in the West End or in Falls Creek, Yale Town, Downtown South, Coal Harbor, and throughout the downtown, 75% of those people do not take a car to work. They either take a bus, a taxi, walk, take a bike. And that's that shows you the advantage you get, the virtuous circle you get when you get complete communities that where people can live, work, and play in the same area, or can take a good public transportation system as an alternative to commuting in a car.
But in terms of thinking of the region as a whole, do you think that we've done a good job at connecting ourselves, like if you live in Abbotsford, for example, getting to Vancouver by public transit?
No, we've got a half a system in place now, and the real challenge, particularly of this reconstituted TransLink agency, which had a very, very aggressive strategy to build out the bus system and some rapid transit lines like the Canada Line and increasing the roads, the arterial roads, like expanding the Fraser Highway, building the Golden Ears Bridge and its access roads. We've had some construction, but we're still only halfway there. We've got three or four more rapid transit lines that need to be built, like the Evergreen Line from Lowy to Coquitlam Town Center, extending the Millennium Line from Broadway and Clark Drive all the way to towards UBC, expanding the Expo Line at Surrey Center to Guildford and Newton, and the Port Man to have a fast bus or an express transportation system that connects the people in Chilliwack and Abbotsford, Langley, into Surrey and Coquitlam and into Vancouver. So I think we've still got a ways to go. We're probably 5 to 7 years away from a complete transportation system, which I think is the number one public priority, top of mind of most people in Greater Vancouver.
And Gateway is part of that, correct?
If it's done properly, the Gateway project can be a tremendous plus, not just to move the huge amount of containers and rail cars and trucks and the movement of goods, but also move people around, people around in good public transportation or in their own private vehicles. And I think the good balance of a well-done Gateway project and a Port Man twinning that is done in a smart way, not a dumb way like Los Angeles freeway style, but a multimodal where you've got some of the lanes for rapid transit, some for high occupancy vehicle lanes, some for trucks, and toll people that are one person, one car, particularly at rush hour. I think all of those improvements still need to take place because until you get a complete transportation system for people so they have an alternative to the car, they're stuck.
Your colleague, Mr. Cameron, in the book, disagrees with your opinion of Gateway. Where do you differ?
I think we differ in, I'm an optimist, and he's a pessimist about whether the Gateway project and the twinning of the Port Man and the expansion of TransLink is done with good motives or it's done with ulterior motives by the province to control things. I happen to be an optimist. I think it's a great opportunity to get the province and the mayors and TransLink on the same page and to build out a really extensive transportation system for the Lower Mainland that serves the whole province and country, and internationally it is an important area. It's a gateway. So I think it's more a nuance and a difference in attitude than agree or disagree.
And in anticipating this book, a lot of people have been talking about these decisions that you feature in the book. They compare Gateway to the saving of Strathcona, which you played an instrumental part in back in the late 60s, early 70s. That comparison is not apt.
I don't think it's an apt comparison because the Strathcona Freeway was going to be this horrific freeway from the North Shore along Stanley Park, blotting out the waterfront of Vancouver, destroying Gastown and Chinatown, and a huge swath of good working class and homes that serve Chinatown all the way out to the 401 freeway, and building high-rises to warehouse low-income people in that are instant disasters. So it was going to have a huge, dramatic, negative impact on the city of Vancouver. Whereas the Portman Bridge exists. It is too small. It was built for 30, 40 years ago. And the idea that it's going to pour more people out onto the farmlands misses the point. They're already there. 70% of the growth in the region right now and into the foreseeable future will be in Coquitlam, Surrey, Langley, Abbotsford. And it's my opinion, and that of many others, that the Portman is meant to serve those communities and will have minimal impact on the city of Vancouver. So I think it is not a valid comparison. I think they're valid concerns, and I don't discount the concerns. I don't happen to share those concerns, and I think that if the Gateway Project and the Portman twinning is done as part of a complete compact land use and building up a balanced transportation system that links land use and transportation, I think it'll be a terrific benefit to the region.
You mentioned earlier you dedicated the book to Walter Hardwick, and you have a chapter on Harry Lash. These people were prominent in civic planning and so on in the 20th century. Were they visionary enough that they foresaw the region that we have today?
I think so. I think the idea of livable cities, complete town centers, and a sea of green is the central value that unites Vancouverites. When I say Vancouver, I mean people in the Lower Mainland. So I think they were bang on, and they're still relevant to this day and out into the foreseeable future.
There are two chapters there, one on Gordon Campbell, one on George Peel, and they seem to be quite favorable to them and the work that they did when they were involved on City Council, involved on the GVRD for Mr. Campbell and the GVTA for Mr. Peel. One wonders, were those contributions in the book written by Mr. Cameron and perhaps not yourself?
Well, we did it collaboratively, and I agree with what's in the book. And as I said, in the book, I've verbalized it many times the last few days, that we praise the leaders that have made this one of the most livable cities in the world, across party lines and different orders of government, different backgrounds in terms of whether they're elected, appointed, active citizens. And so we wanted to praise those people, whatever their politics. And Gordon Campbell and George Peel fit into that as well as Joy McPhail and Darlene Missouri and Bob Williams.
In terms of the changing role of the province, that's what a chapter that you discuss in the book. Do you think that changing role of the province of British Columbia is influenced by the fact that yourself and Darlene Marzari served on council, Gordon Campbell as well, and that you went on to provincial politics and that you took that experience from the municipal level there?
I think it had an influence on all of us, and that we come from different political parties, but we come to the same conclusion about what the best long-term vision for the Lower Mainland is. And it's right back to livable and complete healthy communities in a sea of green farmland, watersheds in the North Shore Mountains, clean rivers and streams, and keeping the really important wetlands and significant ecological areas like Burns Bog and others like that in good regional and provincial and federal park and wilderness areas. So I think we've had the same long-term vision that's been shared by a lot of people in this area over the last 60 years. And matter of fact, it was shared by the first city council in Vancouver. In 1886, their first decision as a council was to ask the federal government for a naval reserve called Stanley Park.
Do you find that the public today, the politicians of today, that they have the same willingness that you do to make Vancouver livable and sustainable at the same time?
I think so. I think the challenge isn't people getting that we need to shift from livability, our success there, and building that good base to become sustainable. I think the real challenge is, well, how do we do it? And how do we pay for it? And how do we stage it? And what can I do personally? And what should I be asking, demanding, requesting political leaders to do? And I think we're at the how-to, not the what stage.
And your role currently, you're out of political life, but you're still a member of the Prime Minister's Advisory Committee for Cities and Communities. Are you not?
I completed that report last June. Joan handed the report in, which can be reached on Infrastructure Canada's website. It's called the External Advisory Committee's on Communities and Cities and Communities Report, From Restless Communities to Resilient Places, what the national role should be in Canada's cities and communities. That is being utilized by the present government, conservative government, after being set in motion by the previous Liberal government, and it's resulted in about $39 billion being put in the last March's budget over the next 8 years to go towards cities and communities. So that work, I finished it last June. It's now rolling out into implementation.
I guess what I want to ask is, what's next for Mike Harcourt?
Oh, next for Mike Harcourt. matter of fact, right now I just came out of a meeting to advise the council mayors at the TransLink on a new board of directors to do exactly what we're talking about, is to have a good, balanced transportation system in the Lower Mainland and tie land use and transportation together. So I'm doing that and working on Aboriginal issues with the Nisga'a First Nation and doing some speaking and writing and talking about my favorite topic, sustainable cities. Working with First Nations to become self-governing and self-sufficient, and Rick Hansen with the disabled community to remove barriers. So I've got some really neat, interesting projects and work that I'm involved in.
We were to talk about 3 years ago when you wrote Plan B, and unfortunately you were unavailable when I was available, and I was unavailable when you were. And so it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. In terms of your health, everything is well, I assume?
Pretty well. I'm about 80% recovered, and I've still got some residual paralysis, and I'm doing some human growth hormone and supplementary work on. So that's underway, and thank you for asking. Well, listen, I've enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I appreciate your time, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much. Take care.